Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another edition of Warrior Connection. I hope everybody had a happy Thanksgiving, got together with your family and friends, and made good. For me, Thanksgiving is kind of bittersweet. 45 years ago to this week, I went over to Vietnam for the second time, and 24 years ago this week, I went over to Operation Desert Storm, which turned into a mess for all of us this week also. This last Wednesday, another member of my original team contacted me for medical help. Like everybody else, his medical records have disappeared. They claim that he wasn't there. He didn't do it. He's got all the health effects specified in the documents, and he's kind of left hanging. Well, this has been a nightmare for everybody, and one of the problems we run into is they don't want to seem to listen or care too often. And as a consequence, some things you might need to look about are legal aspects. We have instances where veterans have been denied care and have died in the parking lot or been denied care and they died at home, and that has happened way too often. So let's talk about the legal ramifications and what happens with the VA. Can we sue these guys? What can we do to hold them accountable? Patricia, are you with us on Warrior Connection?
I sure am. Hello, everybody. My name is Patricia Axelrod, and I conduct the Desert Storm Think Tank and all veterans advocate, as well as a not-for-profit law project called the People's Advocate. And joining us today is a very good attorney and a good friend of mine, a man I trust, and a man I believe has the veterans' best interest at heart, and he is attorney Kevin O'Connor. Kevin, are you with us?
I am. Thank you for having me on the program.
Thank you, Kevin, for joining us. As you know, Warrior Connection is aimed at education and providing information to help the vets. And, man, we sure do need your help, sir.
Let me tell you a little bit about Kevin, if I might. He is the founder of the O'Connor Law Firm and has been practicing since 1993. And his practice centers on individuals suing for issues of complex personal injury, the Federal Tort Claim Act, which is what we need to exercise to sue the VA, wrongful death, civil rights violations, and medical malpractice. And he has tried in cases in both state and federal courts in Illinois and throughout the United States. And he has obtained multi-million dollar settlements and verdicts on behalf of his clients throughout the course of his career. He has sued the VA, and he's going to tell us how to go about it. And joining us as well is Kevin's client Terrell Green. And Terrell, are you there?
Yes, ma'am, I'm here.
Okay. Terrell is suing the VA, and Kevin is his attorney. And Kevin, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, but I wanted to sing your praises as a man who's well worth the effort to contact.
I appreciate that. What people need to know is there is a right to sue the VA. There are some limitations related to that. And when you're ready, I'll be glad to describe some of those things that can be done in order to go against the VA and the doctors that, or the lack of medical care that's given to our veterans, which is a shame because they've given, basically put their life on the line for us. And when they return home, people seem to be just kicking them to the curb.
Why don't we start out with Terrell? Terrell, explain what happened to you, and that will give us some background to lead into Kevin, and then you have the free rein to explain what you need to tell us. Terrell, could you please tell us what happened to your father and you?
Well, me and my father, he was not feeling good this particular day, and so I had to take him to
the hospital. Let me interrupt here, if I might. Terrell's father was Lawrence Sinnen. He was a veteran of the Vietnam War, and he was a Purple Heart recipient. Please go on.
And he didn't feel well that day, so we went to the VA hospital so that he can get some kind of help. And on our way there, he collapsed and fell to the floor. So we got him back into the car, and we went out there to the VA. And once we arrived, I just knew that I was going to the right place. And as we got there and the people told us that we weren't at the right place, to go back outside, get in the car, and drive them around to the other side. And I started getting nervous. And I begged and I pleaded for them to come and help him outside, but no one would come and help him. And so I got back out of the car and went up to the valley or to the ambulance and asked them to help. And I was instructed again that they couldn't help. So we waited, and I couldn't take it no more. So I went back up to the ambulance, and I demanded that they help, that they have somebody come out there and help us. And as that was being done, as they made the call for someone to come out there and get us, the ambulance bay doors opened up, and we went inside. And once we got inside, we had to wait another 30, 40 minutes for them to call a code blue. So, you know, in my heart of hearts, you know, to see a Purple Heart veteran die like a dog in the street at the VA is just really unfortunate to me.
So in short, what happened here is this. Terrell's father, Lawrence Finnan, had sought help from the VA in the past. He was a well-established patient at the North Chicago VA, and Terrell's father, Lawrence, woke up and said he didn't feel good, and he asked Terrell to take him to the VA, and Terrell did so, and he pulled up at the valet, and which serves the ER patients, the emergency room patients, and the valet said, "I can't help you." Terrell raced in and talked to the ER receptionist, and she said to him, "You go around the back by the ambulance bays. They'll help you." He raced around the back, and he got out. There was an ambulance there, and he went up to those men, and he said, "Help me. My father is sick. I fear he's dying. Help me." And they said, "Move your car over here and wait." 20 minutes went by as Terrell begged for help for his father. During that time, Lawrence Finnan died like a dog in the VA parking lot. That's what happened. And thereafter, the VA has made every effort to cover up the facts of this case. They have destroyed the video footage, the CCTV footage of this. They have made it difficult for Lawrence to obtain the medical records. I mean, for Terrell to obtain the medical records. And so, in comes our knight on in shining armor, Kevin O'Connor, who has taken on Terrell's case and is suing the VA for Terrell. So, Kevin, tell us what will happen here. Tell us how the process goes on. How do you sue the VA?
Yeah, Kevin, just start from the beginning and give us a basic 101. The show is yours, sir.
Sure. What you need to understand is that when you sue a unit of the federal government or an employee of the federal government, there's certain laws to protect them from being sued. And it stems back actually from England, to where the king can do no wrong. Technically, our government is the king, right? So they greatly limit how much you can sue the king. So, for example, in most cases and in most states, and the basis of our civil justice system is you're entitled to go in front of a jury to have your issues heard. Under the Federal Tort Claims Act, which is actually under 28 U.S.C., which is United States Code 1346, all claims against a federal government or a government employee, including the VA or for medical negligence, must be brought pursuant to the Federal Tort Claims Act, and you are not entitled to a jury trial. So that's the number one difference, that you're not. So you have to bring your case in federal court, and it has to be in front of a federal judge who's also employed by the government, who's ultimately going to rule on your case and decide what you recover. Fortunately, these federal court judges are appointed for life, but unlike state courts where you get to change judges if you think a judge for some reason is biased or prejudiced towards your claims, you don't get that luxury in federal court, so you are stuck with whatever judge you're appointed to. And that judge could be appointed by somebody that doesn't believe in civil suits or cases against doctors, or one that truly believes at it at their core. And so the job of a lawyer is to educate the judge and realize and tell them that, you know, when we have our veterans and we have people like Terrell's father who are Purple Heart recipients, that we can't leave them on the battlefield, as the old saying goes. We need, when we get back home, we got to hold people responsible who are not taking care of them. So what you have is you have to run through certain loopholes here in order to make a claim. And it's very tricky. And if you try and do it, you can try and do it on your own. But most of the time, they're gonna bury you in the paperwork or the procedure. And if you fail to do something wrong, you can run into a problem. So the number one thing is...
First step, Kevin, is to get the records, right? Get those medical records, right?
Right. What people fail to realize is that sometimes medical records get lost or get changed. I've actually had cases where I was able to show that somebody on the medical personnel made changes to the medical records after they learned that a case was going to be brought. And the best way to fight that is as a patient or the patient's family member, if they're deceased, is you go in and get a copy of the records right away and you bait stamp them or number them at the bottom to show exactly what you received and the order you received them. Because what you'll find is as when the lawyers order the records later and they know there's a case, sometimes some of those records will change or disappear and you have the benefit of getting them before they know a case is coming.
Right. So in Terrell's case, we did obtain the records from the North Chicago VA where, in fact, Lawrence died. So we had those records before we went forward. Correct, Kevin?
You did. And that was a very good thing. And Terrell and Patricia, as his advocate, moved forward and was able to obtain those records with a lot of difficulty, mind you, because they tried to claim that, well, you're not the representative of the deceased person. You've got to prove who you are. They make you jump through a lot of hoops, and they manage to get through those hoops to get the records. So the number one thing, yes, is to get the records. The next step in the process is you have to fill out what they call a Form 45 or a claim form, and they require you to go through an administrative process before you're even entitled to bring a lawsuit. And what that means is that the local agency, the regional office to where your claim happened, you have to submit your claim in writing to them, and you have to be very specific in the damages you request. And whatever number you put on there, you can't raise later when you bring suit in federal court. So if somebody didn't know better...
Kevin, let me interject something if I might. That's a Form 495, and veterans or survivors or family members who are thinking about suing the VA, please take this advice. If the VA is cognizant of wrongdoing on their part, they will do their very best to have that veteran or the family member sign and complete that 495 themselves. And they will tell you, we'll bring in help for you to complete that 495. That's a way of tricking the veteran, essentially, into making a claim that in no way will cover the suffering and the pain that the veteran or the family member has experienced. They did their very best to trick Terrell into signing a 495 himself and to dissuade him from bringing in an attorney. So bear this in mind. That's the first thing you want to realize, is they're going to try to outwit you, and they're going to try to outfox you by having you, the veteran or the family member, fill out that 495 right then and there, lickety-split, before you can even give it any thought. They want you to fill out that 495. Don't do it. Call an attorney. Call Kevin O'Connor or some attorney. I'm sorry, Kevin. Go on.
That's okay. That form, as she described, which is nicknamed the Form 95, they require you to make a specific request for what you claim is the number, and it's a way for the government to say what is the maximum value of this claim, and it truly is the maximum value of your claim. The problem with somebody on their own filling that out is if you write some outrageous number and you start writing in $10 or $20 million in that number, that form is going to be reviewed by the federal court when you get your right to sue and actually go into federal court, and could actually harm you if you try to claim something that's outrageously high. So it has a, it can have an effect up or down either way, and it's people think it's a pretty simple form because it's only two pages, but it's really not.
It's really very complex, and it is a success of the completion of that 495 form that will determine the outcome of the litigation, which is why you must have an attorney assist you in doing this, and don't allow them to con you in, don't allow the VA to con you into believing that this is a simple form and you can do this yourself, you don't need an attorney. They'd like to buy everybody off for a few thousand dollars if they could, and that's what they will do if they have the chance.
I think the important thing to remember, and this is what my experience is and all of us have discussed, and we've discussed on Warrior Connection now since the beginning before, is the VA is adversarial and not an advocate for the veteran. I mean,
exactly.
If they were adversarial, if they were an advocate, they wouldn't need the patient advocates. If they did everything right and provided the care everybody needed according to the requirements, you wouldn't need to sue them. We wouldn't have the medical problems. But
that's
obviously,
so
the VA is an adversary instead of
friend.
An advocate. Kevin, as you run into these problems, how difficult is it for people to understand how evil the VA can be?
Well, the problem is that they have administrators that are like social workers. So every time something goes bad, the first thing they want to do is hold the family's hand and say, we did our best, we tried our best. And they want to, like, keep you in the dark and not provide you with all the information, because if you're relying on these people who you think are your advocate when they're really not, because at that point they're trying to cover themselves, and they say, you know what, your father died of a heart condition. There was nothing we could do for him anyway. We tried our best. You know, we're really sorry. We really look out for our veterans. You won't know for the better, and you'll walk away thinking, well, these poor people, they did the best they could. It's terrible. I mean, I can tell you that I went to trial in a case here in the federal court here in the Seventh Circuit, which is in, you know, the Midwest, and the doctors fused the wrong disc on the neck of a veteran, and he still needed that surgery on the part that they failed to fuse, the spine of his neck, where he had terrible pain. And the doctors, what you learn through this process is you're not entitled to sue the doctors individually. So some of your rights you give up. When you file a lawsuit against the VA, which, by the way, I jumped ahead a little bit, once you fill out that 495, which we described, and you submit that to the VA, you have to get what's called a right to sue letter, which means they evaluated what they said, we're not going to pay you your claim, or we're not willing to pay you your claim. And there's time limits that they have to respond, which is usually 6 months. And then you have the right to sue in federal court if they have not settled your claim or have given you the permission to do it. If they write you a letter and give you permission to sue, you now have a statute of limitations of 6 months. And in order to file that claim, the form, and to make a claim with the regional office, you must do that within 2 years. And they
right,
won't
and
even allow
if they
allow
don't give you permission, you can still go forward, right, Kevin?
Correct. That's if they just hang on to your case and try and keep you dragging on, you have the right after 6 months, if they failed to act, to bring your case forward into federal court. It's as if you got the right to sue. But the statute extends for as long as until they give you a letter that says we're not honoring your claim. And so what you want to do is get that in the process as soon as possible, because otherwise you have a six-month holding pattern to where you're not able to bring your claim, and a lot of things could disappear or go away in 6 months. So you have to really act on these quickly. The second part that I was talking about is, now let's assume you got the right to sue letter or the 6 months elapsed after your claim, and you go into federal court. People don't realize you have to sue the United States of America. So whoever it is versus the United States of America. Dr. So-and-so was screwed up. You cannot name them personally. You cannot go after them personally. You are suing the United States of America.
Yeah, that's pretty important for people to understand. The physicians are not liable for charges of malpractice. They are exempt from charges of malpractice. It's very important for people to understand this about the VA, This is why I might add, I advocate for the abolishing the VA, because they are not held to the same standards as civilian physicians. And in fact, in the VA residents, those are junior doctors, essentially. These are student doctors can practice in the VA under very loose guidance and oversight by a physician. If a resident is practicing on a patient, on a veteran, the physician who is allegedly maintaining oversight of that resident is oftentimes nowhere near that resident, maybe in the hospital, perhaps, but nowhere near that resident. So it's very important to understand the quality of care that a veteran is receiving. And it's important to understand this because this is why there are so many acts of malpractice or malfeasance in the VA, because veterans are not getting the best quality of care.
It's funny, along the line, we know that the poor care is there, delayed care is there, ineffective care is there, denied care is there, but yet somehow everybody in the nation seems to believe as if the VA is out there to service of VA, take care of the veteran. I mean, it's a bad week for me, I mean, all the time. And so when the reality strikes hard, you've got a disaster, you've lost a loved one or the individual is seriously injured, and now they're just in a medical and psychological turmoil at the same time to have all their wits about it. I mean, it seems to be a total nightmare, isn't it, Kevin?
Well, it can be if you're trying to wave through this stuff on your own, because, you know, the administrative nightmares, the headaches, you hear that, well, that's just how it is at the VA. You can't stand for that. We can't, as a nation, as people, we can't tolerate that you're going to get substandard care from the veterans, because veterans just assume, I've gotten such substandard care for years that that's just how it goes, and I'm kind of stuck with it. Patricia has talked about and advocating, and I only heard this from her recently, to say, why do we have a VA program at all? What, you know, why aren't these people all covered under Medicare and they can go to any private doctor they want? But if you're a veteran, you should qualify for Medicare and you should be able to get that treatment, and we wouldn't need all this oversight. We wouldn't need all these additional hospitals. We would be able to have it covered under our private system. And it's an interesting point, because both of you are absolutely right. These doctors are a little different. When you're going through that veteran system, young doctors love to be in that system. Why? Because usually the residents, which are basically the newbies, right, of doctors that are still in training, get to rotate through their surgical residency at the veterans hospitals for a year or two. The attending, which is the supervising doctor, which I've learned through the many cases I've had, under the administrative rules of the veterans hospitals, they only have to be, quote, in the vicinity of the doctor actually that they're training, which means they could be in the break room, they could have four surgeries going on at once, and they just need to be around in case there's an emergency or something happens. Well, with surgeries, if you're not in the room and an emergency happens, the chances you're going to be able to make a difference on that person are slim to none. And then when you try and go bring a case, you'll find that these young resident doctors have now moved all over the country once they've finished their residency. They took on a job on the East Coast, West Coast. Sometimes they're in England or they're maybe out of the country. And a lot of these answers to what happened become difficult to find. And why did it happen to my particular father, mother, brother, sister, or me, right? I mean, once you're in that situation. So it's a unique set of rules that are really unfair.
And let's bring out the fact that the VA is not subject to punitive damages. So, for instance, in the case of denial of care, and we know, Doug and I know, and Kevin, you may know as well, that there is oftentimes even malicious denial of care, because the veteran has perhaps annoyed the doctor, whatever it might be. There might be intentional malfeasance in play and at play, The bottom line is that the VA is exempt from punitive damages, meaning that there can be no, quote, punishment imposed upon the system or the individual physician or the practitioner here. So the physician is well aware of this. The practitioner, the physician at the VA is well aware that he or she is exempt from claims of punitive damages and or malpractice. So therefore, we wind up with a quality of care that is far inferior to the quality of care that the average civilian is receiving.
You know, this all brings to mind, and then the question I've got to ask is, I retired out of the military with some 35 years in the Army and the Air Force. Why would anybody enlist if, when they get wounded, ill, or injured, and they've got to fight for medical care within the military, and then they get out of the military and they got to fight for medical care in the VA, and they find out that, well, hey, I'm sorry, we just ain't going to give it to you. I mean, it comes back to the fundamental question of rightness and everything else, and I mean, that's totally different than the legal aspect we're talking about, but there's something seriously, seriously wrong with the system. Kevin, is there any hope that we could ever get the system corrected?
Well, you know what, and Patricia brought this up because people like her and people in these groups have brought up lawsuits. There's been a recent case in the Ninth Circuit, Veterans for Common Sense, that went after a regional VA office for failing to, for leaving people by the curb, letting people die. You know, we've heard about it on the news, and the only reason that the president and everybody else has picked this up is because of this opinion that was written out of the Ninth Circuit, which is the Federal Court of Appeals, that basically said there are a number of veterans dying, injured, killed as a result of the lack of appropriate care at these facilities. And the judge actually instructed the federal district judge and remanded the case back to the district judge to say, you better find a remedy for these people. And if the regional office is not making a change, that the court, in essence, is going to oversee and make sure that they make a change. And I'm hopeful that that will start to permeate through the rest of the system, because that is only the Ninth Circuit, which doesn't cover the whole country. But hopefully that sent a pretty good message.
Could you explain what you mean by circuits? I mean, you've discussed this, got the Sixth, Seventh Circuit, Ninth Circuit. What does all that mean in legal mumbo-jumbo for all of us that don't know the law?
Right. Well, you have state law claims, which means you bring it within the state court. If you're a veteran bringing it against the Federal Tort Claims Act or against the federal government, you are not allowed to file in state court. You have to bring it in federal court because you're suing the United States. So, first of all, you're not even entitled to go into your local county courts or to your circuit courts where you live. So once you're in the federal system, the federal system has a number of circuits for different areas of the country. So, for example, in the Seventh Circuit, it's mostly Illinois, Indiana, some of Wisconsin. It's the Midwest group of people. The Ninth Circuit, I believe, is California, covers a lot of California. So you have different circuits of federal governments that apply. So you have your state, United States District Court for the district of wherever. That can be Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, whoever it is, California. Then if you appeal that case, it goes to a certain circuit, which covers several of, like, the Midwest states or the Seventh Circuit. The West Coast is the Ninth Circuit. Then the ultimate decider is the U.S. Supreme Court, where they can decide if there's a difference among the circuits. So how the court system works is you have to have jurisdiction or control over the people you're ruling. So if you have a case that arises out of Illinois, the people in California and the judges that rule out of Illinois, they're not bound by those decisions. So until or unless the case gets up to the U.S. Supreme Court, which is why that's so important, then everybody's bound by those decisions across the country. Otherwise, the decision from the Ninth Circuit, which governs California, is instructive in the Seventh Circuit or in the Midwest, but it's not binding on them, if that makes sense.
That seems goofy as heck. I mean, you get a decision for the veteran in one district, but in another district, they don't have to do anything. I mean, there's something really wrong here.
Well,
that's why we have our Supreme Court.
Right. This particular case, though, because it has not been remanded to the Supreme Court, will establish case law. So the Veterans for Common Sense, the case that we're talking about, that Kevin is talking about here, in the absence of further litigation, will stand as case law. Unfortunately, what will happen here is that in the absence of the VA acting to enforce the order of the court, which was to ensure that there were more PTSD counselors, more suicide counselors, more mental health made available, mental health facilities and services made available to veterans. In the absence of the VA acting to comply with the court, then unfortunately it may be plausible that each of these hospitals would then have to be brought into court with charges brought against them of contempt of court. That might be the only way that that would in fact be litigated. Correct,
well, you're
Kevin?
Absolutely right as to one of the problems. Both of you are correct, and here's the problem. So we have this Ninth District decision that governs the regional office of the VA out of California. Let's assume for a moment the regional office out of Illinois says, you know what, I'm going to thumb my nose at that. I don't want to change any policy. We're going to keep going the way we're going and leave people at the curb like what happened to Terrell's dad. Well, then somebody has to file suit in federal court, district court, here in the Northern District of Illinois. They have to essentially argue the exact same things that were argued in the Ninth Circuit. The district judge has to either agree or disagree with the Ninth Circuit decision. It then will go up on appeal to the Seventh Circuit, which is a different circuit that governs Illinois. And if those judges agree with the Ninth Circuit, there's nothing for the U.S. Supreme Court to hear. If the Seventh Circuit judges disagree with the Ninth Circuit, because they say, you know what, we don't think there's such a big problem in the VA, then the U.S. Supreme Court, when there's a conflict among the circuits, has to hear the case and ultimately decide what the remedy is going to be. So that's our system, unfortunately, because all of our states are supposed to have individual rights and, you know, separation of powers so that states can't be overcome by the federal government. And ultimately, if it's a violation of your constitutional rights, which veterans have a constitutional right to care, then you can bring that in front of the U.S. Supreme Court to ultimately make that decision. But they have to agree to hear the case. And in the United States case here that we've been talking about that was in the Ninth Circuit, the U.S. Supreme Court declined to hear the case. So because there is no conflict among the districts, they didn't want to touch this political mess and start talking about something before there's a conflict.
Well, what does remedy mean? You've used that term a whole bunch of times, and I'm not sure all of us understand what remedy means in the legal sense.
Okay, well, a remedy is you getting action or compensation or the judge declaring something on your behalf. So if you're wrong, every wrong deserves a remedy, right? So if you're wrong, you have to have some way to correct that wrong. That correction can be awarding somebody money damages, but that's the least effective because it doesn't affect every other case. But in the case of this Veterans for Common Sense that happened out of the Ninth Circuit, the remedy there is the judge says, I'm going to demand that the district court follow and see what the the regional office is doing and make sure that they've changed their policies to have protections for the veterans. So that's actually a remedy in and of itself without a money value to it. And that's the more important remedy, is that something actually changes.
Now, what is the likelihood? Okay, we've got a definite definition of a remedy out there in California. We got the same problem here where people can't get proper care under psychological PTSD and everything else. So no remedy being applied. How do we force that to happen?
Unfortunately, that's through our legislature. So, and that's the difficulty that the court had with this case, is they said, look, you're asking us to tell the government and our commander-in-chief, which the whole separation of powers issue we always talk about, you know, can the courts tell the president what to do? Well, they can if it's violating somebody's constitutional right. But the problem is that who's going to micromanage the VA? It's not going to be a federal court judge who's got other cases on their docket that's going to hang out at the VA to make sure they're giving people their rights. We have to have some kind of legislation passed. We have to have something to where our representatives and senators are taking an active approach to say, you know, these people running these regional offices need to be changed. They need to be moved out. We need to establish policies and procedures that protect veterans. There should be no longer wait times than X amount for people that are waiting for services. There has to be a clear delineation as to what doctors, nurses, emergency staff must do under circumstances. This is the policies and procedures hospitals have developed over the years because of medical negligence cases that required them to establish these so to prevent future cases from coming about. So when people hear about this outrageous, you know, there's all these lawsuits and therefore, you know, there's this tort reform needs and we need better protections for doctors. I'm telling you, the only reason these policies and procedures are in place to protect you, prevent you from having your wrong arm cut off in a surgery, is because there's been a lawsuit where somebody's established that their policies and procedures failed. They failed to have a checks and balances, and they were required or made to change it because they had a large judgment against them. And that's their only motivating factor.
So let's come back to that and discuss this again. So here we are, Kevin, and we'll use Terrell as an example. Terrell gets his records, the records for Lauren Sinan. You fill out the 495, although, in fact, I know full well because I was on the premises while the VA did everything they could to talk Terrell into just signing off on a 495. Now, you take the case on a contingency basis. Remember this, folks. An attorney takes a case against the VA utilizing the Federal Tort Claims Act on a contingency basis, and discuss this, dear, and the attorney's fees, and how long do you suppose it might take to resolve this? Let's follow through with that.
Yeah, contingency fee, all that simply means is that you don't owe a fee unless the attorney wins. So that's the basic definition of it. In most cases that are involved with medical negligence, the attorney's fees are one-third. And people say, wow, why is it one-third? Well, because a lot of these cases are lost. They're very difficult to prosecute. But the one thing that the federal system did do is because they didn't want people to get a lot of attorneys, so a lot of attorneys have moved away from these cases, is they've restricted the amount of attorney's fees that could be charged when you sue the federal government. So if you settle the case before filing a lawsuit, the fee is only 20% of the total recovery. If you settle it after filing a lawsuit or if there's a judgment went all the way through a trial, the fees are 25% go to the attorneys. And that's mandatory under the federal system, and any attorney who charges more than that is subject to a fine of not less than $2,000 or imprisonment for a year or both. So it's pretty strict that they make sure that the amount of fees being charged comply with the federal regulations.
And unfortunately, this does discourage many attorneys from taking cases because of the fact that, as Kevin points out, it's generally one-third. But the attorney that takes this case, I can assure you of this, any case who is that is where the VA is the litigant, this is an attorney who is following his or her heart. Kevin has a big heart, and he fights for justice, not just rich. That's where this man is coming from. Go on, Kevin.
And then the next part of that is, how long does it take? Well, unfortunately, it's a bench trial in front of a federal judge, which makes it a little quicker because you are in a system to where you don't have to wait behind everybody else. But in general, it takes about 2 years. But even after you go to trial with the judge, because the judge, for example, in federal court, because they know it's a bench trial, they'll squeeze you in among their other cases. So on one case that I tried, the judge heard some of the evidence on one day, and then he said, okay, come on back next month for the evidence on the next part. And then after that month, we came back for one day, and he said, come back next month and present your evidence of the further witnesses. So it was a slow process. And then even after all the evidence was done, we did our closing arguments, the judge said, I'm going to take it under advisement and I'm going to give you a ruling. Oftentimes, it takes 3 to 4 months for the judge to come up with a ruling. And in my case, that one I was talking about, it took over a year. So you really don't have a method of enforcing or telling the judge when to come forward with that decision, although I didn't mind the wait because the judge came up with the right decision for the veteran. But that's a situation that the veteran is, you know, justice delayed is justice denied, right? So the longer it goes on, the veteran is without money to get the treatment they really need. They're without money to take care of themselves if they're truly disabled from whatever the doctor did. And the provision that doesn't allow for punitive damages or to punish the other side also doesn't allow for interest. So even though you were entitled to the money a couple of years ago, you don't get interest on that money when it's awarded. So every delay possible by the VA, by the U.S. attorney who's representing the VA, is all to their advantage because they don't have to pay out the money.
You know, I keep coming back to the same thing. The entire system is set up against the veteran. It's set up against justice. It's set up against truth. For example, General Eric Shinseki, when a one-star general signed the order mandating medical care for all depleted uranium casualties, he didn't enforce it as a one-star general. He then signed the Army regulation as a four-star general mandated again. He didn't enforce it as a four-star general. Then when he became Secretary of the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs, he didn't enforce it within the VA. And the whole system is broken, and hence guys are dead, they're dying, they can't get proper care. And I get another member of my team who yelled at me this last Wednesday saying, help me, help me, help me.
But
why should anybody enlist in the U.S. military or trust them?
Time is running out, and Kevin, I want you to please give your phone number and all of your contact information. We don't mean to discourage you, veterans and family members. We're just giving you the truth. We're giving you the skinny. The fact of the matter is, you can chew the suckers. You got to have a strong stomach, and you have to be prepared to wait. And you've got to find an attorney who will do so. And Kevin O'Connor will help you. He will serve you wherever you are throughout the United States. So, Kevin, please give all your contact information.
Sure, it's Kevin O'Connor at the O'Connor Law Firm. My email address is koconnor, KOCONNOR, at koconnorlaw.com. So KOCONNOR at KOCONNORLAW.com.
And your phone number?
I have a 1-800 number, which is 1-888-233-1560, or you can call me directly at 312-906-7609, which is the office number. It's Kevin O'Connor with the O'Connor Law Firm. I'm centered. My main office is out of Chicago. I've handled cases around the country. Unfortunately for people, I've been admitted pro hoc vice in a number of, which means for the purpose of a case in a number of other states. It's a sad state of affairs, you're correct, for veterans. If you don't have an advocate on your side to help you, your chances are slim to none. These cases are against doctors who are very knowledgeable about certain medical issues, and they have a tendency to try and confuse the judges who are not doctors on the medical issues. And unless you have the right team of experts and the right lawyers behind you, it's a very, very difficult battle. And it literally is a battle. So you're fighting on the battlefront for our country, and then you're coming home and you're fighting for your care. And then if you get the inappropriate care, you're fighting in the federal court again to try and get compensation to at least cover your expenses when you're not being treated properly. So it's an endless battle, unfortunately, for our veterans. Until the president actually steps up and takes affirmative action that's sweeping across the country for veterans, whether that's eliminating the veteran system and changing it to a Medicare-based system, which unfortunately I don't think will ever happen because there's way too many jobs associated with administering and overseeing veterans and veterans affairs, which jobs create more voting blocks for a number of people. So I don't see that hope in changing that portion of the system. But you know what? If you go to your representatives and your senators and you demand, whether you're a veteran or not a veteran, it doesn't matter. It affects us all. To see our veterans homeless, suffering from, you know, mental illness and suffering from things because of what they've seen in a war is a terrible, terrible state of affairs. And it shows that our country takes the most important and the most honorable people in our country and throws them away. You know, it's not unlike when people from the East say we do the same thing to our elders, right? On the anybody that, you know, comes from the East says, how can you not treat your elders with dignity and respect for their knowledge and understanding? How do you not treat your veterans who are our true heroes that put their lives on the line for the rest of us with dignity and respect? And our country takes the people that deserves the most dignity and respect and really throws them by the side because they don't have an interest in them, because they're not politically important.
And Kevin, thank you. I mean, what you're talking and what you're describing today, I mean, you're giving us some idea of what the problems are and how to fix them. But in trying to fix these problems, you're really highlighting how bad it is. And I mean, for those of us that have been there, done that, got the T-shirt, that psychological realization that we've been abandoned is a nightmare. I mean, just a living nightmare. And then what I've experienced, and now Patricia's experienced, and Kevin, you must experience this on a daily basis, the family members come to that realization. It has got to be a horrific, horrific, you know, statement in life, or, you know, a life-changing thing. I mean, what, where do we go to then? What do we do? How can we get by?
Well, I tell people, and Patricia is one of those people, you must advocate for yourself. When you're a veteran, you know, and I know a lot of veterans don't have a lot of that family support behind them for whatever reason, but you need to have an advocate with you when you're in that hospital. If you're going in for a surgery on your right arm because they may amputate your arm, you know, for some terrible injury you've had, you better take a black marker on your good arm and write, do not cut, you know, or do not touch, right? And you've got to have somebody there with you to talk to the doctor before you go in. Why? These residents, the doctor who's operating on you may have never met you before the day they're going into that operating room. And unless you have an advocate who's there, because you're going to be under anesthesia, unless you have somebody that says, I demand to talk to the doctor before he starts the procedure and say, doctor, what are you doing? How are you doing it? And make sure that he's on the same page, you run a great risk. So I tell people, you've got to be, you know, speak up. Even if it's not you speaking up, have a family member, have a friend, have a fellow veteran there for you to speak up, that you give consent to speak up on your behalf, to make sure you're getting the proper care. Because unless you're asking, nobody's going to tell you, nobody's going to protect you. And if you're asking enough questions, they may stop and give that extra 2 minutes of care toward your case and not rush on to the next one because they know there's somebody watching out for you.
Is there a last tool for preparation? Obviously, Kevin, what you've discussed today, just a 101 few minutes. But how does a lawyer learn all of this information? Where can they gather information to start helping the veterans? Or is it taught in law school, or is this kind of like on-the-job training where somebody has to come to you or somebody of your partners that agree with you and do the work you do?
Well, the problem is that you do not learn this in law school. There is no class on veterans' rights, or there's no class on how to sue the VA or the federal government. The only thing you learn in law school is you can't sue the federal government in state court. You have to sue them in federal court. The rest of it is all learned from doing it and actually learning about it. I would tell people, if they want to attempt to do this, you should always have somebody at least consulting with you that has been through the process before, or you're really going to, even if you're a lawyer, if you've not done a claim against the Federal Tort Claims Act or against the government in the past, simply writing the wrong fee agreement can subject you to a year in prison. So you better be careful if you haven't done it the right way, and you haven't done this before. So even if you're going to take on, because perhaps you got a family member that's a veteran and you're a lawyer, you need to at least consult with somebody who's done this before to make sure you're taking the right steps to secure this evidence. Then once you go through the process, you've got to read these federal statutes that directly apply to the Federal Tort Claims Act. And unfortunately, you've got to read at least probably 50 or 100 cases that have come down related to suing the VA and coming through with the VA to know what the pitfalls are. So if you're going to take it on, it's a huge task. And the way you're punished is that huge task gets you a lot less of a percentage of a fee. So a lot of lawyers don't want to go through that extra work or effort to get a smaller fee, because on the average case that they have come in their office, they can collect one-third. And instead, they're not only going to prosecute a medical negligence case, which are very expensive. You have to have a doctor in a similar area of this doctor saying that they breached the minimum standard of care. Minimum. Not the A doctor, the B doctor, the C doctor. They have to violate what a D doctor that made it through school with all D's did in order to bring a case. And then you can do that for about, 40% less of a fee. And so, it really unmotivates the a lot of lawyers from actually taking this on. And so the quality of representation, unfortunately, from what I've heard from other people, is that, well, the lawyer told me that whatever they offer, I should just take, don't file suit in court. If it's $20,000, $30,000, whatever it is, I should have taken it. And oftentimes I'll look at their case and say, that seems ludicrous to me. Let me, and they'll ask me to take over their case, and they're worth substantially more. So it's a sad state all the way around. Given that circumstance.
And do let me warn
one thing that is true, we know that all of us that are veteran advocates and everybody else that tries to get their problems corrected face retaliation. Have lawyers and everybody else, other lawyers or legal expert, also face retaliation because of their efforts to help veterans?
No, and I'll say that's the one side of it that, the judges in the federal court system do appreciate when you're advocating on behalf of a veteran. A lot of our judges in that system either have a family member or somebody else that's been a veteran. They're not immune to knowing the problems that exist at the VA. I think they kind of have to turn a blind eye to some of it, because you can't say the whole system's broke because they don't have a remedy to fix it. But likewise, I think the doctors who are there truly are doing the best they can. But unlike in private practice, they may have 50 patients in a day for surgery as opposed to 10 or 20. So these young doctors are put at a great disadvantage of actually being able to spend the time with the patients. The system is not set up for a doctor to have a patient relationship with their patient and they actually care about how they recover, because your doctor that operated on you may never see you again. He's off doing something else. And so you've got to advocate for yourself, and you've got to really educate the judge who's involved in the case with how important it is, not only for this case, but every further case and every other veteran, that the judge do the right thing.
We've only got a couple minutes left
here. Attorneys. One second, Doug. Let me warn our listeners about attorneys who are advertising online, groups of attorneys who are advertising online and are soliciting business from veterans to bring lawsuits against the VA. The largest number of those attorneys are playing a crap game, essentially. They're taking in as many veterans as they can, and they're settling the cases. They will settle these cases rather than take them to court. They will settle them for $10,000. They will settle them for $5,000. They'll settle them for $20,000, because it's a quick $2,000, $4,000, $6,000, $8,000. Boom, 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 just like that, and they're working on drugs. Watch out for those attorneys. They're out there. You will see them as you're looking for an attorney. For instance, if you go online and you put in attorney to sue the VA and you put in Federal Tort Claim Act, up will pop a website and they'll say, call us and we'll vet your case. They would love to take your case, because they're going to take as many cases as they can possibly get. They have no intention of taking it to court. There's very little incentive for an attorney to battle this out in court from 20% to 25%, right? So if they can settle it for $10,000 to $20,000, they're going to do it. And so I'm warning folks, please don't fall into that trap. Sorry, Kevin.
That's okay.
Kevin, can you give us your contact information one more time, very clearly and slowly? And ladies and gentlemen, it will be up on the archives for you.
Very slowly, sure. Kevin.
The email address, which is the easiest way, is kocononnor at kocononnorlaw.com. So K. O'Connor at koconnorlaw.com. And my office number, the easiest to get a hold of me, is direct, is 312-906-7609. 312-906-7609. Or the 1-800 number, 1-888-233-1560. I come from a family. My uncles were veterans. My brother-in-law is a veteran of the recent wars. I have great honor and respect for veterans. I think they should be held to the highest care, not the minimum standard. But at least they should get the minimum standard like the rest of us get. And it's a terrible state of affairs, and hopefully through these individual cases we can change these policies.
Well, Kevin, thank you very much for joining us in Warrior Connection. Ladies and gentlemen, Gary Noel, God bless you. We continue to educate, inform, and provide you access to the best resources necessary. The whole key thing is to get the veteran the care they need and ensure they're always taken care of. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, and good evening.